American Empire. In an undisclosed location in the Rocky Mountains, tearing down the invisible walls of the overdeveloped world, one interview at a time. The Soulcast with your host, Soul. Today's special guest is Chad Kautzer, philosophy professor at University of Colorado, Denver. He's a Marxist, deeply involved with a lot of activist shit here in Denver. Although he's an academic by trade, he lends his knowledge and skill set to various projects around the city, stuff around class issues, racial equality, foreclosure assistance. He works with the Colorado Progressive Coalition. My favorite work that he did was with Occupy Denver Teach-Ins. He helped lead them for about a year and really put a lot of energy into providing the intellectual fodder for how fucked up shit really is. Chad Kautzer, welcome to my podcast.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's about to snow.
Yeah, blizzard. Coming blizzard.
Well, it's a good thing it's a good thing it's about to snow, because it's proof that global warming doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I feel relieved.
All right, well, so let's just get started. Most people outside of academic circles, you know, they know your work, or from around the community, they know your work from your Occupy Denver teach-ins.
Yeah.
Which, as far as I know, they're the longest-running teach-ins in the Occupy movement, and in my opinion, probably the greatest contribution that we as a community have made to the city. You know, they're always well attended. They're twice a week, and it's like people can go in there and just learn. Like, I've learned so much from the ones that I've attended. So I guess my questions are, what have you gotten out of this? Why did you make this your focus? Have you thought about expanding it outside of Deer Pile and maybe, you know, getting more people involved and making it bigger? And is there stuff that you do at these teach-ins that you're not able to do as a professor?
Okay, those are a lot of questions, so I might forget one or two, so you have to just remind me of them. Let's see. Well, let me back up a second and just talk more about the kind of, from the perspective of the Education Committee of Occupy Denver, what we're doing with the teach-ins. And that is to create a consistent kind of public forum where we can bring people together who have areas of, you know, they have their own area of expertise, and bring it into a common forum where they can share that information with others who are actually involved or on the fence about being involved in a social movement. One, to actually get them involved and actually take action about these issues, and two, to for those who are already involved in these issues, to have them have good theory, right, so that they can have good practice as well. And so that's the idea, and we really push hard. We have some great people working in education here. And so that's my commitment to it, and I think in general with the Occupy movement and with more radical tending toward anti-capitalist social movements recently, there's a lot of new people. There's a lot of recently politicized young people, and the idea is to have a continual forum where they can learn about some of the issues and hear from some organizers and activists that have been involved for decades. And then my specific contribution has been this series called Occupy Economics, which is basically a kind of the ABCs of a radical economic approach, or a kind of radical critical approach to economic life, to kind of get the basics down of how capitalism works, how it's changed, what our relationship is to it, and bring in some forms of resistance and critique. And that's to pick up on the last part of the question. I think how it differs from the university setting, I mean, I'm a professional educator. There are people in the professional left. I'm a professional educator. But there's, you know, much of what I teach is, even if it's considered radical by academic genetic standards is within a particular tradition. The entire model is set up. You can tinker with it to some degree to change the banking model of education, but the entire institution is set up to have people come in and pay, and you hope and you try to cultivate a sense of interest in the actual material, but really the structure is set up that people need the grades and they need the degree, and that this is largely vocational training, and we do our best to kind of interject other forms of education and self-critique in there. But once you remove that institution, you can organize educational forums that are horizontal, that don't have incentives built in, that have anything to do with money or career climbing, and you can speak directly to people's interests and issues and be as political and engaged as you want to be. And I think that's the best kind of theory. The best kind of knowledge is what's knowledge that's tied to particular issues in people's lives. So I think these things have to be expanded. I mean, if we're going to have political change, economic change, social change, we have to develop these kind of radical, democratic, horizontal educational forums.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've definitely gotten a lot out of them, and I think they're fucking awesome, man. So what's going on with universities, with public funding universities in Colorado? You know, right now Colorado is leading the charge on being the first public university with zero state funding. What is going on there and why?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at a local level, this is historically a very libertarian state, and so that translates into very libertarian policies and approaches to education. Any kind of traditional public goods, from transportation, like our roads suck, our schools are underfunded, anything that would be a public good is attacked in Colorado because of the libertarian ideology that's pretty prominent here. So yeah, we are on track to zero out state funding of higher education probably in the next 10 to 15 years. That means, I mean, there'll still be public institutions to some degree insofar as the buildings and the land will be provided by the state, at least for the near future. But the state will no longer fund actual running of the institutions, educators, etc. And that's putting the burden then, because there is a financial burden, I get paid by the state, and if the state isn't paying me, then students have to pay me through their tuition, or corporations have to pay me through their donations. And that's the direction that it's going. So students will, tuition will continue to increase, corporate influence will continue to increase, and the state will continue to withdraw. And this is part of a larger, so that's the politics of the state. We can talk more about that if you want, but this is then within a larger neoliberal context, which is to defund all public services and insert or financialize those institutions so that they can reap profit from it, so that there can be middlemen in there who are making money off of the distinction between the cost of the good and the ability of the people of Colorado to pay. So it's just a general neoliberal process of financialization that we're witnessing here at the local level.
See, and what blows my mind about that is when you look at, like, student debt and how it's, like, you know, it seems like it quadruples every year. Like, the amount of money it costs to go to school, it just keeps going up. And what I don't understand is, you know, people who graduated from college 30 years ago, they weren't paying as much. But professors that's always been a decently well-paid profession. You know? So it's like, where's all this money going? Like what the fuck?
that's a great question. You know, universities spend money on lots of things. Usually the highest paid employee at a university is the football coach. There are... It's true. I think the average is right around $1 million. Yeah. So there are other interests here, and you know, part of that is you have a good sports team, you have a good kind of then platform for commercial investment. You know, if you have a winning team, then Nike wants to sponsor you. Nike wants to give you free shit. So coaches are important in that sense. They basically cultivate a university brand that can then be sold to corporations. But in general, I mean, it's really expensive to run a university and pay people like me who have, you know, one of the reasons it's expensive to pay people like me is that I'm still paying off my student loans. You know, my largest debt is my student loan debt, and I'm a professor, and that means the state has to pay me so that I can pay the banks back for my PhD.
God bless America, man.
God bless America. So the winner in all of this is always the banks. You know, so yeah, but yeah, this is really bad. This is the trend. You have it at the university level by defunding. The state is always withdrawing from paying for public education, and you have the rise of charter schools, which is undermining you know, K-12 level education. So you have the homeschool movement, usually has a kind of Christian right-wing basis to it. These are all attacks on the idea of communities, the idea of public goods, the idea of contributing to something that might not immediately benefit you as an individual, but might create the conditions of a good society. And that's the fight we're in right now. That's the neoliberal world.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's like when I think about what radicalized me, like in my adult life, it was, you know, it was professors, it was people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. Yeah. And, you know, what I wonder is, you know, like those people need to be paid, you know, paid their day jobs so that they can do radical shit on the side. Mm-hmm. And are we going to have that in 15 years? Like, are you going to be having to... You know, I don't know, teach math? Like, is there still going to be a market for anti-capitalist professors in 15 years?
Well, I don't think, I mean, you know, people like, I mean, Zinn may be a little bit different. You know, Chomsky was already an established and quite famous professor before he became the kind of radical public intellectual that most people know him to be. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in particular about university professors or the university in general that, you know, is more likely to fund kind of radical community activists and organizers. It's just that it's unique insofar as the content of a lot of the courses and research that university professors do have to do with history, political systems, theories of justice, and so this and critical thought, and that in itself is already more than, in a political sense, more than a lot of other professions are contributing to kind of political culture. And so there's an easier transition, I think, in the field. But I don't see, no matter what happens to the university system, I don't see somehow that being a problem for the development of like radical public, I don't know, public intellectuals, maybe not the right term, but people who are engaging in local, national, international politics that are informed about history, political theory, etc. I don't see that as a problem. I see it as a problem that that people are becoming more and more indebted and thus more and more tied down and disciplined by this system. And so I worry more about the students than I do about radical professors. I don't think they'll be fine.
Yeah, that's good. That's good to know. I mean, but you know, Barnes & Nobles are closing down everywhere. Like, you know, the books are going the way of the record, that's for sure. Okay, so maybe it's just that I'm more aware now of what is happening around me, but it seems to me, you know, we have a Democratic mayor, you know, surrounded by Democrats, yet the class war is accelerating all over the city right now. Like, I see projects being torn down by my house, and they're rebuilding them with green solar panel places for old people to live. You know, there's no dog parks in the city. You know, it's illegal to sleep outside. You know what? How long have you lived in Denver?
I've been here just over 4.5 years. Coming up on 5 years.
Well, that's longer than me. But anyway, what observations do you have about, like, poverty and gentrification and class conflict in general in this city?
In this city, okay.
Or the state, whatever.
No, that's fine. It's a great question, because it's all over the place. Let me just start with the kind of party divisions. I think this is an ideological commitment that is really hard to shake, because it's constantly reinforced. But this idea that somehow the Democrats as a party represent one class and the Republicans represent another class, this is just empirically false. And you know, there was a time when unions were stronger, and so there was a few kind of party endorsements and candidate endorsements that came from labor, quote unquote, and thus the working class. And with the assault and destruction of the unions, and the dissipation of that kind of collective consciousness among unions, then Democrats didn't have to fight for that or give any kind of concessions to organized labor, because they were no longer organized. They were just individual laborers struggling. So I think this is a fallacy to think that the parties are somehow aligned along class lines. There's no question that the Democrats try to pick up that constituency, whatever, to the extent that labor is organized, they try to pick up that constituency. But, you know, that's not where the funding comes from, and they do more for corporate interests and business interests than they do for working people. So both the Democrats and the Republicans, the entire party systems are... there is no class war happening in the Capitol. It's not like we have somehow just, you know, empowered these parties to fight class war for us. The class war is happening against the people, and it's being fought by both parties. And you see that, like, for example, in the urban camping ban. You know, this is, you know, for those who don't know, this is the criminalization of homelessness. The shelters are full. There's nowhere to sleep. People are being foreclosed upon by the thousands in Colorado, by the tens of thousands, and it's illegal to sleep outside and try to cover yourself. And so now they're busing people out of the city. This is class warfare, you know, cutting education, public education, that's class warfare. Going after the unions, pushing right to work legislation, that's class warfare. That's all happening in Colorado and in Denver. And yeah, you can see, I mean, class warfare isn't just in the capital, and it isn't just, you know, in the site of production or service, so in businesses or factories. It's written all over the city. Gentrification is class warfare. The urban camping ban is class warfare. The you know, shutting down public parks or increasing fees, that's class warfare. That's always shifting the cost of doing business, literally production in the state, from the businesses themselves to the people. So you want workers to pay for their own education, which is basically job training, so that they come in to these companies, and the companies can then utilize that quote-unquote human capital for their own production process or service industries or research or et cetera. So it's all around us. It's written in stone. It's happening at the Capitol. It's happening in our workplaces. So,
have you ever read any Negri?
Yeah, not in a while, but yeah.
I mean, it kind of reminds reminds me, like what you were just describing, kind of reminds me of like how his definition of empire and how like we're creating, like, you know, when we're on Facebook, we're creating empire. And it's, you know, it's like we're generating, you know, we might not have jobs, but we're still working every time we get a traffic ticket or, you know, we get pulled over or get fined. I got a $200 fine for having my dog off a leash. You know, and so we're providing the, you know, whatever, the fund, like we're funding the city by, it just seems like they're fining the fuck out of people now. Like, everywhere I turn, like, there's three times as many traffic cops. You know, there's people in parks where, you know, there used to be, you know, it used to be like dogs running free in all the parks, and now it's like if your dog is off leash, you're getting a ticket, and it's happening to everyone. And I wonder, I mean, to me, it's just really obvious what's going on, you know. And I just wonder how, you know, how concerted of an effort that is. Like, do they make decisions at the top? Like, okay, to increase property value and to raise money, we need to triple the amount of cops. And do you know? I mean, are you privy to any of that information?
Well, I do know. I mean, there's obviously planning that goes on into things like gentrification and, you know, budget allocation. So there's no question that there's very clear choices that are being made. But I think there's a larger, you know, it's not like a conspiracy. I mean, there's just a larger tendency here to defund state services that provide, you know, any kind of public good. And the reduction of revenue streams coming from those who benefit most from the status quo. And so, you know, the corporations, the businesses that benefit most from the state and all of its functions want to pay less and less for that, and they want to shift the burden onto, you know, working people. So what happens is, you know, corporations successfully lobby for tax reductions, loopholes, you know, property giveaways, zoning, you know, law changes that help them. And that then decreases the revenue that the state or city has, and then that they have to go after softer targets, which are people, right? Working people who are unorganized, be they people who are just driving to work or walking their dog, or having to pay fees at a school or having to pay tuition, et cetera. So they go after the softer targets because they're unorganized. They haven't organized themselves to be a collective power to resist. So it's just a matter of shifting the costs from those who can most afford it to those who can least afford it. And this is very much, I mean, I think the process that you're talking about is generalizable. Like, it's creating a loop where the people who are most constrained, repressed, exploited by the system pay for the institutions that exploit them. You see this directly in a prison system where people have to work and produce goods that are sold in order to pay for their own incarceration. You know, at the university, all of the tables and desks that we use in our classrooms, that's all prison labor. Everything that the university uses is built by incarcerated labor. And so, because they have to pay for their own incarceration.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Here's, by the way, to swing back to your earlier question about why it's so expensive. You wouldn't believe how much. This is a complete racket. So the prison system produces all of the furniture for the university, and you have to fill out paperwork to make a case why you might need something else, like to buy from someone else. But they're the primary vendor for the university. And just like the Pentagon, you know, with its $900 hammers, you have super expensive pieces of furniture produced by prison labor, by slave labor, are sold at 10 times the market value to the university. And so that's state and tuition funds going to buy prison goods to, you know, furnish the university. It's a general trend. I mean, and there's nothing conspiratorial about it. I mean, who wouldn't want this, right? I mean, if you're powerful and you have the power to determine the rules of the game, you're going to minimize your risk, minimize your costs, and try to put it off onto weaker players in the game. Right? That's the capitalist logic. That's capitalism. So that's what we're seeing, and it goes all the way down to ridiculous fines for walking your dog without a leash, man. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I tried to fight it and I lost. I brought my strike debt manual to court. I tried to fucking take it to court and jury it, and I tried everything and nothing worked. You know, they were just like, I was like, all right, we'll fine them. Like it's $200 to take it to trial, or you can just pay the $150 now. And it's like, And I was like, well, all right, well, what if I just don't take it to trial and I just don't pay it? And he's like, well, we'll go into your bank, take the money ourselves, and then you'll be charged another $50. I was like, fuck, I've lost.
You know, this too is an old strategy, right? This is, you know, we're in our reading group right now for Occupy Denver. We're doing The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And, you know, it's a beautiful book, and it walks through in prison history this strategy of, you know, you find people. And if they can't pay their fines, it used to be that they can go to prison. But here it's usually then they lose. So if your car is impounded, for example, the fees to pay that are over $1,000 for the towing and, you know, whatever the random fees they tack on there. And poor people, working people, they can't afford that. So if they get their car towed and it's impounded, they don't have enough money to get it out. Boom, the state gets the car. Right. So this is always the case that it's the system of appeal is more expensive often than the goods you're appealing to get back, and so it's not worth it. And then there's of course the threat of retribution. If you actually try to fight it, then you can make enemies, police, legislators, you know, the legal system. So you know, I mean, it's just you cut your losses. And if you have funds, if you have wealth, you can fight it. You can fight the smallest thing and dump lots of money. So financially, it's a losing game, but you're doing it out of principle, or you're doing it because you want to make a point to the people who are trying to screw you over. Poor people can't do that. You got to pay your fine, right? Or if you don't, if you can't afford it, then you lose it, right?
Man,
I'm getting angry now.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know why. I'm like, I don't know why I asked you this. Like, now I'm bummed out, you know. let's lighten it up a little.
I don't know what you're gonna ask.
So the only time I've ever understood the mortgage crisis is when you
want to talk to mortgage crisis.
Well, we need to lighten it up, man.
I'll do my best to lighten it up. All right. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, don't. I'm just kidding. The only time, honestly, like, I've watched a million documentaries on this, but when you explain the mortgage crisis and financialization, like, I understand it. And so, can you explain it real quick? Can you explain it real quick or quickly, or can you explain it?
Define.
just explain it, man. Put it into terms that the 99% can understand.
Right. I mean, it's where should I start for a quick explanation? I guess a quick explanation, it would start with the banking industry. You know, Glass-Steagall was a piece of legislation that happened after the Great Depression. And what it did is it separated banking services or types of banks. So it separated commercial banks that, you know, those are the banks that you go to when you're in downtown Denver, where you have your savings and checkings account, or if you have those. Those are in local banks. They, you know, do car loans. They will sell you a mortgage. And those were separated from investment banks, so banks that are basically taking funds and investing them in financial commodities to try to get returns. And so what used to be the case was that until 1999 was that when you wanted a mortgage, so you wanted to borrow money to buy a home, you would go to your commercial bank, you would show them your credit history, you would show them evidence of your future ability to pay, they would calculate the risk, and then they would extend you probably a 30-year mortgage with a fixed interest rate. Depending on your credit, you'll get a different interest rate. The kind of context to this is the financial component of capitalism. It's all about, or at least on the surface, it's about justifying risk. So the riskier you are as an investment by the bank, the more they charge you. If you're less risk, you can get a lower interest rate. So in general, built into the logic of the system is poor people who have greater risk have to pay more for everything in general. So back to the mortgage industry. So you would get a fixed interest rate, 30-year mortgage. You would pay that. The bank would make the interest on that. You'd probably end up paying, you know, upwards of double the original amount. And the bank makes that money over 30 years. And that's how they survive, right? That's their purpose, is to extract that money from your need for a house. 1999, there's a bill that repeals Glass-Steagall, and this is part of a whole slew of new laws that are deregulating financial markets, and this has to do with a larger kind of crisis in industrial capitalism. So you have a push toward finance capitalism to increase profit margins. So what you have now is you have, I go to my local bank and I say I want to get a mortgage for a home, and they will give me a mortgage, and then they will sell the note to an investment bank. If they aren't already an investment bank, they'll sell it to an investment bank, and that investment bank will take my mortgage, which is debt. So basically, it's a claim to a revenue stream, my revenue stream, so that I will have to pay every month money, and some of that money will go to whoever owns that note. So basically, they then take that note and they put it into a pot with a bunch of other mortgages, and it's called securitization. And then they take out little slices of that pie or that pot, and they sell them as financial commodities on a market. And the reason they do this is that they distribute the risk. So these slices can have different levels of risk because they have different kinds of mortgages included in them. And then they sell those on a market, and they get traded on a market as these debt commodities. So what happens is at the entry point of this process, which is me going to the bank, the first person I have contact with no longer gives a shit if I have good credit or can pay, because they're going to sell it immediately to an investment bank. So they'll get their money right away. They'll be covered right away. And so they don't need to worry. And this is how it worked. The securitization started in the 70s, as did most kind of financial neoliberal policies. And eventually, you kind of soak up all the market of people who have the potential of paying. But the investment banks want more because they're making shitloads of money on these transactions. So they're pushing for more people to enter into the mortgage market. So this is where you get predatory lending. And this is why it makes capital, like financial sense from capital's perspective, which is you want more of that debt circulating. So you go after the people, and because you think you've distributed risk enough, you go after people who would never get a mortgage 10 years ago, and now they're getting mortgages for twice what they could logically pay. And then that debt circulates, and they trade that debt. And what happened is, once you have a downturn, and you have a kind of systematic, across-the-board collapse in that revenue stream, because millions of people can no longer pay their mortgage payments, then you have a ripple throughout the whole system, and everyone's trying to calculate the risk, and they can't. it's actually, I mean, one of the kind of bedrocks of finance capital is trying to calculate risk, and they couldn't do it. And that was really what the crisis was, the financial commodities had become so complicated, and people had owned different parts of different mortgages and different revenue streams, and they couldn't assess what they had, so they couldn't assess their problem. And that froze up the market, the credit market. They didn't know what they were dealing with. This is when we talk about toxic assets. The toxicity came from bad mortgages and inability to calculate risk. And that brought down the system. So I don't know if that helps as an overview, but there are a lot of different factors contributing to this. But the outcome then is that the banks got bailed out. And the people got fucked. So people lost their homes, destroyed their credit history, and the banks were bailed out. And so, in a way, the banks, I guess, were right, because they did distribute risk. You know, they offloaded it to the borrowers, and they came out okay, you know? Did that cheer you up?
Yeah, I'm just like, God, man.
And let me localize this, which is one of the things I didn't talk about. I don't know if you want to get into it. Is credit default swaps. This is a nasty little financial mechanism. It was invented by J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan just gave last year $5.5 million to the business school at the University of Colorado Denver, my institution, to create a center for commodities, which is a center to create commodities like the credit default swaps, financial commodities. And so they're the business school is busy designing entire master's programs around the center, and J.P. Morgan is financing, the study is taking all of this kind of human creativity and innovation and energy and putting it into the invention of the next wave of financial commodities, which is... doesn't cheer me up, I have to say.
Yeah, I don't understand why students don't just go occupy that building and shut it down, you know?
Yeah, I think in part it's, I have a feeling that's going to happen eventually. I think people just don't know what's going on yet. I think it'll take a little while. I always bring it up because, most faculty don't even know that this is going on. Most people don't know that J.P. Morgan invented the credit default swap. And that was one of the ways, one of the mechanisms, kind of the cancer cells of the finance capital that brought us into the recent crisis. Most people, aren't tying those things together. And this is why we need to talk more about this. This is why we need to educate people who are not in the university system about these processes and how these things work, and identify the agents that are doing this. I think it's really important.
Yeah. So here's the thing I don't understand is when you always hear these stories about people getting foreclosed on, even though they've never missed a payment, and they try to track down who owns their deed, and they just can't.
Yeah.
What is going on there? What is that about?
Yeah, this is a serious problem. What's going on is that, it's complicated because different states have different systems, but usually what's happening in general is that you have a bank and then a mortgage servicing agency, and the mortgage servicing agency is usually the one that will initiate the foreclosure process. And so what's often happening is you have people who are negotiating with the bank unbeknownst to, or the mortgage agency doesn't care, to the folks that you might be communicating with at the mortgage agency. So there's usually at least two contacts and two people that have, or two agencies that are related to your mortgage. And often it's the case that the mortgage agency will start a foreclosure process and not care about it being based on evidence or, you know, your payment history, because they're going to get paid no matter what from the bank for doing these services. So it's you know, right now there's legislation proposed in Colorado to change this, to collapse the system into like one stream, so that homeowners can speak to the people who would initiate a foreclosure process, who would negotiate principal reductions or, you know, some kind of loan modification, so that there aren't several agents working sometimes against each other or against the homeowner. So this is a huge problem.
And to me, it just seems like it's like, you know, for that, like a lot of the shit that capitalists do, like what you describe with the university, like that doesn't make sense, because it's, they're not making money really. It's like they're generating money, but it's a huge fucking waste. Whereas with this, it's like, yeah, you initiate a foreclosure on somebody, you've already collected $40,000. You can kick them out of their home and keep the 40 grand.
Right. And you have the house, right? So the bank gets the house and then sells it, you know? You know, and you know, we've, from Occupy Denver, we've gone to the auctions. We've gone over downtown and watched this process where they're selling off homes. You know, it's, and we've disrupted them. This is a crime. I mean, it's not a crime that you can catch on, you know, some video camera or something at the corner store. This is a crime that has multiple agents, happens over time. People are confused about the process, so they don't know where to point the finger. They don't know who's at fault. But these are crimes that upend the lives of people way more than robbing a grocery store, right? I mean, people are losing their homes, their businesses, their livelihood, everything. They're losing everything. You know, suicides go up, breakups increase. It's this unbelievably traumatic experience. And no one is paying the price for it, right? There's people are, because we have this kind of Christian capitalist culture of everyone is responsible for what happens to them. If you get screwed over, people feel ashamed. And this is the common theme among people who are going through foreclosures. They feel ashamed. They don't want to talk about it because they think it's their fault, right? And this is huge. This is such a problem. It's really upsetting, man. But I have to say about the J.P. Morgan thing. I mean, you know, what happens is J.P. Morgan is financing studies of master's students, undergraduates that will come through the business program. And so if they're financing their research, the university can pay their bills by the money that's coming in from J.P. Morgan. And universities are always they're always hoping that their alumni have money, because they want the alumni to then donate back to the university once they're making money in their career. I went to Stony Brook University in New York for my PhD, and I always get pitches. They always want my money, and they're always pitching. It's so funny that they always pitch like the sports team, physics, and business, telling me how I need to give money so that these programs can thrive. And they never pitch the humanities, right? Because there are very few corporations who want to give money to the humanities to finance PhD students. And the humanities folks that graduate don't go and make a lot of money that then they'll fund the university as through alumni donations. So, anyways, is there any happy questions?
You know what? First of all, this is all, I mean, I don't know. Whatever. This next one is definitely much lighter. But, you know, whatever. This isn't Sesame Street, you know. So, in my world, and in like the music world, and kind of like with the age group of like, you know, half interested YouTube stoners between the age of 18 and 35, like there's this like push where people are always watching and quoting things from movies like Zeitgeist or you know, some Alex Jones documentary or 9/11 Truth, and you know, I actually don't think 9/11 was committed by terrorists, but that's another story. But one thing that I, like an argument that I always get into, which I don't, a lot of people don't really understand, or talks about the Fed. Like a lot of people are always saying, like, we need to end the Fed. And me and Stephen Polk were sitting in on this, like, forum the other night at the Denver Social Forum. And, you know, and this guy was, you know, two steps away from saying, to talking about reptiles and Illuminati while he's talking about the need to create a state-funded public bank to compete with the Federal Reserve. So I guess my question is, like, you know, is it important that money is tied to the dollar? What do you think about the Fed, and what do you think about public banking? You know, I've heard it described that when gold was discovered in America, because the European money was connected to gold, it crashed their economy and there was mass starvation. So yeah, can you talk about the relationship between the Fed, gold, money, etc.?
Yeah, I can say a few things about that, but I actually want to address the conspiracy theory element too, because I think it's really important. This is all kinds of conspiracies, political and economic, the Fed, you know, often being the economic kind of conspiracy theory, usually are coming out of a political framework that is very impoverished. So what I mean is that the way the person is analyzing the institution and the social relations around the phenomenon, so here, like being the Fed or, you know, being certain political decisions at federal level, state level, etc., is impoverished insofar as people are not giving an institutional, structural, social critique. So when people have an impoverished view of the social world, they often can't think of political and economic processes as functions as parts of systems, of structures. They have to somehow see them as attributable to an individual decision or a small cabal of, you know, a small group of people making some decision, right? And this is an incredibly dangerous perspective. And I see this. I'm now old enough to have gone through several social movements and see always that conspiratorial analysis come up. And it's usually a part of the left. I mean, it's definitely on the right, but I'm concerned about the left. It's usually people will, and I see this all the time over the years, people will be attributing certain political and economic phenomena to some conspiracy, and they'll continually try to engage the public about this conspiracy. And then eventually they'll realize that the public isn't going to believe them, and they'll end up saying, well, fuck the public. They get what they deserve. I tried to tell them. And you have this kind of dictatorial tendency in this conspiracy analysis, where if the people don't get it, that they're being duped by some, you know, overlord, right?
Yeah, you need to wake up.
Yeah, if you can't wake up, because eventually they burn out, the conspiracy people, they burn out. And then they blame the people, and it reinforces this, well, they're suckers and they deserve it. So I've seen this all this. I see this all the time in social movements, and it has to do with the kind of analysis that people are putting forward. Right? They're not giving an institutional analysis. So they're not giving an analysis of, for example, how capitalism functions, and how, you know, in a Marxist perspective, for example, how individual capitalists are not choosing how capitalism runs. They are fulfilling a role that's afforded them within the system, and they're trying to bend it to their advantage, of course, and maybe changing some of the rules a little bit. But if they don't fulfill the role of the capitalist within capitalism, they will no longer be a capitalist, right? And that's a system analysis rather than an individual choice analysis. It's not about voluntarism. It's not about individual choice. This is not to say that there aren't conspiracies in the sense that, you know, the Koch brothers get together and they create a bunch of astroturf groups to try to sway local city councils or state governments. Of course that happens. You know, that's a conspiracy in the sense that a group of people decided to sway public opinion and legislation and not make it public. That happens, of course. But that's different than some group of people running a world government or something. So anyways, I just wanted to put that out there because I think, you know, there should be a red flag whenever conspiracy theories come up about, you know, and there's a hoax or there's you know, everyone is being duped in this global conspiracy.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's like, because I understand that language, and for me, I agree. It does. It comes from ignorance and people not really understanding the way that things work. And I always try to, you know, engage those people and say, well, you know, take out XYZ group that you're talking about, and just imagine how capital and power and these systems function. And, you know, it's more abstract, and like people don't want to believe it's more abstract. And I mean, my conspiratorial aspect thinks that like maybe I tend to think like that is a function of the system, is to get people lost down these wormholes. You know, it's like that is exactly what they want you to do, is to like still be rewinding JFK videos to figure out how many people killed him, as opposed to like looking at, you know, UNICAL drilling in Afghanistan, you know.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. I mean, the idea is that, okay, what if everyone believed your conspiracy, then what, right? And it's not going to change the fact that we need to organize a mass movement to change the status quo. Like, that does not change. So somehow, like, if everyone all of a sudden believed, oh yeah, this is a big conspiracy, like 9/11 was an inside job, like, what would that change about the structure of the state, about forms of exploitation and injustice, right? It doesn't, it's not a mechanism for change, and it's a misidentification of the problem. So, but yeah, I mean, I could go on and on about that. I think, you know, the early Frankfurt School theorists would call this a kind of authoritarian personality trait. The tendency toward conspiracy theories to explain our world is a facet of an authoritarian personality. And I've seen that manifest. I've seen the conspiracy theorists burn out and then become very explicitly authoritarian in their politics. But just quickly, and then this is the same thing about the Fed. I mean, I think there's no question that, I mean, the Fed is, you know, it's private interest, it's capital interest. So, of course, their policies are geared toward perpetuation of a system that benefits capital, period. Of course, that's what they are. So, but I think this emphasis and prioritization on the Fed is coming from a libertarian context, like somehow the manipulation of money is the problem. So if you eliminated the elimination of money, then somehow you would get this Rand Paul, equalizing, harmonized market system that is Pareto efficient. So it's like the most efficient form of production and exchange, and somehow we can have a more just system if the money just wasn't manipulated. And that to me is you know, I don't share the foundational kind of assumption to that critique, that somehow the injustices and forms of exploitation that we experience are somehow attributable to private private interests manipulating monetary policy. I mean, of course, it's even a strange thing to talk about manipulating monetary policy. I mean, capital controls monetary policy. It's not manipulating it. It's just the way it is. There's nothing secret about it. But I don't think monetary policy is the source of the problems that we face in economic life and forms of production and consumption and sustainability. Right? I don't think that's not the ground on which everything is built.
Well, then why is it then? You know, when you used to go, when I was a kid, which was not that long ago, which was maybe 20 years ago, when I would go to the store, I could buy a whatchamacallit for 50 cents, and now a whatchamacallit, which is a candy bar, is $1.50. Is that just like why is that?
Oh, inflation. Well, I mean, you get inflation, so the increasing cost of things, and a lot of what the Fed is trying to do is keep down inflation. And there is an interest here. So if I'm in debt, which I am, which you are, which almost all of us are, and there's high inflation, that means the value that I was lent, right? So the property or something that I used the money to buy, the value of me paying back the money decreases if there's high inflation. So if I borrow $20,000 and then there's tremendous inflation, so, 10 years later, $20,000 is $60,000, then I'm paying back less of the value of my debt. They're making less money from me. It's inflating out my debt. So there is an incentive to keep inflation down because debt repayment would lose its value, or debt repayment loses its value to the extent that inflation increases. So there's certainly a monetary policy and tendency to try to keep inflation low in order to keep the system of debt repayment profitable.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So it's like,
yeah, I mean, this shit's really confusing for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, okay, let me go for the whatchamacallit. So like I borrow 50 cents from you to buy a whatchamacallit today, and then I say, give me till next month to pay you back. And in that month, there's inflation, so the cost of goods go up. That whatchamacallit, let's just say in a month, goes up to $1. But then my wages go up as well to account for inflation. So people are always, there's a proposal, Obama threw out the idea of increasing the minimum wage. Why? To keep up with inflation, right? Let's just say that happens. So there's 50% or 100% inflation, so the whatchamacallit is now $1. My wages have gone up. So now I'm going to, before I was getting 50 cents an hour, now I'm getting $1 an hour. So I give you 50 cents back, but everything, the cost has all doubled in the meantime. So now when you go to take that 50 cents and buy a whatchamacallit, you can't even afford it.
Right.
So the value has of the 50 cents has decreased level, relative to the commodity. That's good for me, because now the same commodity I bought a month ago, I'm paying you back for half of its value now because of inflation.
Maybe that's why when a record label or a publisher or anybody owes you money, they just hold on to it for as long as they can without having to pay.
Now they're coming.
It's like maybe they just understood something that I didn't. Like, they were being smart and...
No, I mean, the worst thing for banks is to have runaway, for finance capital is to have runaway inflation. Then you inflate out and they lose the value of the debt that they own.
Right.
So they don't want that to happen. And one of the reasons that we have the Fed is to create policies to keep inflation low so that debt is still a profitable industry.
And where does gold, where does the gold standard tie into this? A lot of people attribute, like, going off of the gold standard as, I don't know.
No, again, I mean, it's like...
Is it the same thing?
Well, that's a, I mean, it's somewhat related. I mean, you have, you know, once you float the dollar or currency, you know, no longer peg it to something else in the economy. It just floats against other currencies on the market. Floating meaning now it's just up to, it's no longer tied to a concrete, literal element in our world. It's now subject to almost entirely speculation about the future of a particular country's production and GDP. So once you float the dollar, you disengage it from gold, then it's purely subject to speculation on the market. And so it fluctuates. It fluctuates depending on national debt, depending on wars, depending on GDP and productivity. All these things get factored into whether or not people are literally going to start investing in money. And so currency then becomes a commodity that's traded all the time. And so you get fluctuations. But you had fluctuations with gold, too. I mean, this is all tendencies in capitalism are toward kind of multiple levels of speculation on value, on future value. And so this just happened with money. And you're right about the history of gold. It was the Spanish who, you know, the different forms of European colonialism took root here in the Americas, depending on the kinds of economies that they had. And so, like, the British came and they wiped out the indigenous populations because they wanted to do agriculture. The French came and colonized, and they were into trade. The Spanish and Portuguese were into mining minerals. And so they extracted a lot of minerals, more silver than gold, and imported it back to the homeland. And this crashed the economies. Yeah. I mean, the point of trying to tie money, is to make it somewhat stable, because what you're tying it to has some stability and predictability and rarity. And so if you discover tons of gold, then you undermine that function of having a stable foundation of value for currency, right? And so the influx, it's, you know, and it's, this is in the gold market now, right? I mean, there's, you know, surely more gold discovered than is on the market, because if it entered the market, all the gold owners' value, it would drop. So that process happened when the dollar was tied to gold until the 70s. So, but it fluctuates, right? I mean, it's a false sense of security. And what we've seen is just with the floating dollar is now the speculation of the value of the currency. So currencies are, there's a currency market and currencies are traded against each other. Yeah,
I mean, it's funny because it's like, you know, libertarians, which is, the word libertarian is just obscene to me, but the libertarians are always like, oh, you know, buy gold. And it's like, you know, because when capitalism collapses, you're going to need gold. It's like, what are you going to do with that gold? Like, who's going to cash it for you? Like, do you really think people are going to be buying shit with gold? You know, and, you know, because in their worldview, everybody's going to be slitting each other's throats, you know?
Yeah, it's Yeah, it's a really skewed, yeah, and you brought up the libertarian term. We should maybe clarify that. So basically, I mean, because in the European context, when you say libertarian, it's usually like anarchist. So, you know, in the tradition of anarchism, a kind of what we might call left libertarianism, there is a fundamental critique and suspicion of capital, right, of capitalism as a system and capital as a social force. In American context, we're usually talking about libertarians as being have a fundamental critique and suspicion of government, of the state, but in a blind faith in capitalism. And that so somehow capitalism is radically democratic, and that it's just certain institutional regulatory functions which skew it to produce inequality and inhibit freedoms. And so American libertarianism is like an inversion of European libertarianism. And so these ideas about this fixation or obsession with currency is because they think that currency is the source of the problem of and that problem is the undermining of individual freedom. So if we could only have a non-governmental or unregulated form of currency, if it would just be able to be subject to market forces, or that we would all be subject to market forces, and currency would be tied to something concrete in the world. It's a beautiful, like, people want to be able to touch and see and be able to imagine the value of something. This is a kind of fetishism, like, so you feel more sure or certain in the economy if currency is tied to something concrete in the world. And the idea is that if that could only be the case, then we could all be free.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, yeah, I mean, there's nothing more dictatorial and totalitarian than capital, right? So I mean, there's no critique here of the function of capitalism. It's just a critique of currency and attributing all the problems of capitalism to currency regulation. And this is so problematic. In so many ways, and it's ahistorical. It's built upon fetishisms. It's crazy, and it's really, really unfortunate that we have a whole generation now of this kind of libertarian thinking among what would traditionally be leftist sectors of the polity, right, of our communities. So you have this conflation of right-wing pro-capital libertarianism and left-wing anarchism. And it's, I think, it's going to take a little while, and probably going to take another crisis to clarify those two tendencies and get them separated again. But they've been conflated now for about two decades.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny when we think about Occupy Denver. I mean, I think like the liberal radical divide was pretty strong, but mm-hmm. the libertarians versus the anarchists, I think, was the most violent. We could talk about that all day. I mean, it's just fascinating to watch it unfold. I mean, that war continues, you know? And, like, the libertarians don't even understand where the fuck their philosophy comes from. They think it was born from Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
And, like, how did that happen? Is that Proudhon? How did anarchism get distorted, or like how did this branch of libertarianism shoot off like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think there's a lot of different factors. I mean, some of the big ones would be that the Randian philosophy is pushed. You know, everyone, and I know so many people that come into my classes and they've read in high school and love Rand's books, right? And it's all full of this stuff. this is these are and I've talked about this in my teachings, you know, these are the zombie ideas. These are the ideas that don't die. They're not accurate. They don't describe the world. They're not good in an analysis, but they reflect the dominant ideology and class interests, and so they just live on. Like, you can criticize them, you can show why they're completely self-defeating. They have no basis in history, they have no basis in fact, but they live on, and they're very powerful. This is ideology because they represent the dominant interests. So that's kind of the positive influence here. We have, you know, organized groups that are pushing this libertarian line. The other is that you have the disintegration and disorganization of the organized left. You don't have large organizations that are teaching their membership or their, you know, people associated with them counter history and facts. So you have, and this is terrible, right? I mean, you know, some of Marx's great writings, for example, are when he was giving lectures to, like, Working Men's Association. You know, this is just like people organized that come together and learn about how the economy works, right? And you can do that and organize those things, just like the educational, you know, teach-ins that we do at Occupy Denver. You can do that once enough people come together and organize themselves. You can start creating institutions to educate people, right? To educate ourselves. And those forms of organization have been under systematic attack. They're always under attack, but in particular with labor, for the last 50 years. And so you've lost the basis, the foundation, the social organization where those kinds of left critique would take place. And we're left with right critique and all the media that perpetuates it. So it's really too bad. I mean, it's so, you know, we just need to learn more about history, more about economics, more about political theory, so that we can, when we're faced with these really erroneous arguments about currency, about individual liberty, about history, that we can debunk them immediately, right? And that's, I think, that's why I think, you know, all of my energy of the last few years has gone into public education, because I think that's a war that's being fought. There's a war being fought over ideas, and it has very much to do with this distinction between state and capital power. And I think we need more. We have to continue that fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane, man. It's crazy. It's giving me ideas. It's giving me ideas, but we can talk about it later. But I feel like there's something. There's a lot we could. There's a lot that can be done there that hasn't been done yet. But all right. Well, we've gone way over, but it's great because the second half was so much more interesting than the first questions I asked. But like so much interesting shit. I'm going to edit this also. So, last question. Mm-hmm. One of the current things you're working on is on self-defense subjectivity.
Yeah.
What is this? How do you explain this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so this has to do with this libertarian tendency. I'm going to get all philosophical on your ass because that's what this is, a philosophical concept. But it's coming out of a lot of the stuff that we were just talking about, which is this libertarian tendency, not just on the right, but actually kind of insinuating itself into leftist political views. There's a tendency I see in the States in particular toward a new kind of subjectivity, which is a kind of combination of our self-understanding and our and the institutions that support that self-understanding. So we are moving not just more in legally towards more libertarian politics, but our self-understanding is becoming radicalized around the concept of right. And like before, I talked about how people, there's something psychologically satisfying about being able to point to or touch the origin of value. So gold, for example, is very appealing to people in terms of currency because they feel like they can get a handle on it. And this is in part because we don't generally understand the source of value, which is us, but it's socially produced. And so we tend toward solutions or views of the world that allow us to get some kind of concrete handle on things. And I see this, there's a crisis, and there's been a crisis over the last several years in liberalism, in liberal thought, of this kind of striking a balance between individual liberties and, you know, state organizations and institutions. And as liberalism is going into crisis and we're seeing a kind of polarization of political ideologies, within that polarization, you're getting new kinds of self-conceptions that are developing new forms of subjectivity. So how we see ourselves as political agents and then how we act as political agents. And the self-defensive component is that part of, in one of those forms, in one of those poles, in this process of polarization away from kind of traditional liberal political ideology and self-understanding, is this radical understanding of right. It's kind of a return to a natural rights discourse that is still pretty prominent among libertarians. This often happens, like I said, in times of crisis, you want to grab onto something, and then the libertarian end of the spectrum, people are grabbing onto right.
What do you mean by right?
You know, the history of rights is incredibly rich and interesting history, but basically it's involved the internalization of the concept of right and its appropriation by the subject. So individual subjects become the bearers of right rather than having, which is a subjective form of right, it's connected to a subject rather than objective forms of right. So rights that are produced by the state. So the right for you to walk your dog, the right to express yourself, these are rights that are political rights, and they can be changed, right? And they are, at root, they are ways of mediating your interactions with others in your community. So your right to walk your dog is matched by an obligation by others to allow you to walk your dog. And so these are, at root, social relationships, ways of relating to other people. Natural rights, which are then called human rights, are the idea that somehow rights are not social in origin, rights are not created by the government, but rights are somehow inherent in the individual as individual. And so rights are not just a way of talking about social interaction, rights are essential to the person. Now this, if you, you know, look at Marx on the Jewish question, for example, Marx sees this, and I think it's a good critique, the emergence of this understanding of right has to do with the emergence of capitalism and private property right. And understanding the state in terms of contract is coming out of private contract and private capital. So what we have now is we have this kind of return, in a sense, to this hardcore natural rights understanding of the individual. But the self-defensive part, I think, is new, which is we're seeing there's a general suspicion coming over people on the right, of the social in general. So, you know, right now you see this proliferation of arguments about why everyone needs a gun everywhere all the time, because you're the last line of defense. And so everyone needs to carry a gun because the police aren't going to help you, the sheriffs aren't going to help you, the state isn't going to help you. You're the only one that can help yourself, and you need a gun.
You had to go there, didn't you?
We don't have to go.
No, I won't shoot you. Keep going. I'm sorry.
But the idea is now that social is no longer, this is in a sense inverting the kind of concept of civilization. The idea that the social is a sphere of cooperation, of social production, of mutual aid, to where everyone is a potential enemy. And that we have to start with the individual and their rights, and we have to arm them against the social. Right? And this is a creeping, this is, so in more concrete terms, I'm going to talk about guns a little bit, because that's what this is connected to. In 2008, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that the Second Amendment was an individual right to bear arms. Like, the first time ever. So, it's not militias, it's not the army, it's not the National Guard, it's an individual right to carry arms. You get this proliferation of stand your ground laws. What is that? That's a transformation of what's called the Castle Doctrine, the idea that if you're in your home and someone enters your home or tries to, you can defend yourself with deadly force. That principle is now been extracted away from any kind of physical environment, and is now just located in the individual. So stand your ground is the Castle Doctrine incorporated or appropriated just to the individual. So wherever I find myself, I can use deadly force if I feel that there's a threat. There's no obligation or expectation that I will leave, that I will de-escalate, that I will do anything to eliminate the threat besides pulling a weapon and killing the person. And this is what, so what I'm saying is that there is a tendency that we're seeing toward the individuation of violence. So a devolution from the state's monopoly on violence to the individual. And it's understood in terms of rights. And that has to do with a certain crisis in political liberalism. And so that tendency and that self-understanding, I'm calling self-defensive subjectivity. It's something new, I think, and it's something that's tells us a lot about where kind of cultural norms are going. It has to do with property right. It has to do with a certain libertarian tradition, etc. So that's the kind of thesis that I'm working on right now, among other things. But I think it's something new.
Well, it's so funny because it's like it reminds me of like I lived in Northern Arizona for a long time, and all in the middle of fucking nowhere, and all my neighbors were libertarians. Mm-hmm. And if you needed anything, they would give you the shirt off of their back. You know, they're such kind people. But when you talk about society, you know, I would never go to L.A. because I can't bring my gun. You know, yeah. I don't believe in socialized health care because poor people are going to suck up all the resources, even though they themselves had to declare bankruptcy because they had to pay for you know, their hospital shit. And so I think it also kind of goes back to that teaching you did about ideology, you know, maybe 6 months ago, about how, you know, ideology trumps facts. And yeah, I don't know. That's very interesting, man.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the last thing I'll say about this is that there's no question that there's an economic, in a sense, principle or variable at play here. So, you know, you tend to get the more libertarian views in rural areas where production is either agrarian or land-based. So you get people who actually own property and are involved in economic production where they live. You know, it's a farm, it's a ranch, etc. And you don't get that kind of production. And then it's about protecting their property. So they get guns to protect their property. You know, you don't get that in urban. You don't get that in cities. You don't get that in urban environments. That's why you get rural sheriffs talking like it's, you know, the 10th century.
Yes.
And then you get, you know, where everyone should be armed. There should be no regulations. And people should carry guns everywhere all the time to urban police politics, where you get them saying, no, guns are a problem. They're a it's a public health problem. That has to do with production and property ownership. You know, I don't own any property in Denver. I rent an apartment. The form of production, which is knowledge production and the service industry of education that I work for, is run in part by the state, in part by private interests. But I don't own that. It's not where I live. I go to my job. I ride public transportation. There's a certain form of consciousness that arises from that kind of environment. My relationship to property, my relationship to land is different than folks who live in rural areas, right? Who live on their own private property and actually earn their livelihood from it. They have a different sense of security, of right, notions of society and violence. They're just different. They're different forms of consciousness because they live in different ways. They have different relationships to property and production. And so I think we need to be aware of that, that there's a reason that, you get more liberal views in cities than in rural areas. It's because production is different. And when you live in cities, you're much more aware of the social nature of production. You're much more aware of the interdependencies in a society. You're much more aware of the value of public services than you are when you live in a rural area that has a small population. So, yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there because I think if we don't make that distinction, we don't understand some of the battle lines that form around issues like individual rights, violence, property, etc.
Yeah, I mean, that's hella important, to be honest. That's kind of what I always thought I wanted to live in nature, but then after spending enough time in the city, it's like, you realize how, like, this is where all the conflict is. This is where everything is happening. It's beautiful to be in a city.
I love the city. And we're lucky in Denver, too. I used to live in Wisconsin. It was like this in Madison, Milwaukee. Older, you have these urban centers, not too here, but these city centers, and you step a half a mile outside of those centers and you're in farmland, the mountains. That creates for incredibly kind of distinct political clashes, between distinct ideologies, but it also is it's kind of nice to be able to do that, to escape to the mountains.
Yeah, it is nice. I mean, and it's nice because it's like we live in a city, but it feels pretty suburban. It doesn't. I mean, it's I love Denver so much. It's so European to me. I guess I don't know. My last question for you would just be: any recommended readings?
Oh,
like just five books.
Just $5. Let's see. I mean, I would, on political history. I mean, Howard Zinn, People's History, is a great book. I'm just gonna go for basics, right?
Yeah, that's great.
I would say, something like we're reading The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. That came out 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago or so. That's on racism and the prison industry, or also the legal system and policing functions. I think it's a fantastic book. I think I would highly recommend that. I would recommend on neoliberalism reading people like David Harvey or seeking out his lectures online. For history of some of what Harvey is talking about, I would read Marx. And I would also recommend, I mean, in people like Harvey and Michelle Alexander, you're going to find a lot of references and citations in their work, and you can follow up through them. So, yeah, those are a few that I would give. And then maybe the strike debt manual.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good.
Very practical forms of information and resistance.
Chad, thank you so much for your time.
I enjoyed it. It was good to talk to you, Tim.
And all your hard work, man. Keep it up.
Yeah, you too. You too. I hope we see each other soon.
All right, brother. Peace, man.
Yeah, take it easy, Tim.
Later.